No, no, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Did you get that thing, Ramika?
Yeah, I looked up. The University of Texas has like the archives of the whole summit, and they have a day by day account. It's just like there's nothing different. There's nothing there, so there's nothing really. Different.
But how do you know he was out of office by then?
That just the biography. We'll say it.
Where'd you get the biography?
On Wikipedia. It says, you know, so far.
Do me a favor. So write down his name. I'll write. I'll get his biography tomorrow. Okay. Gentlemen, first of all, we're rolling, right? I want to begin. It's exactly 5:30. It's February 13th, 2011. It's Sunday, and I've been rolling in many areas. I finished Shas Mishnayos, I don't know how many times already, and I told my grandson, who I have a 14-year-old, who's what a head in this kid's shoulders. So I told him. I started Masechet Chulin. Chulin and Nidah stand between me, Bezrat Hashem, and my second Siyum Shas, Al-Haseda. You understand? I've learned many Masechet many times. So I'm making a deal with the Ribbono Shel Olam, keep me going for a third and a fourth Siyum Shas. But I attended last night the book launch, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. I'll talk about his book, it's not for today. But I attended the book launch, and I thought to myself, I looked around at the crowd, I thought to myself, when you reach, and they announced Rabbi Riskin turned 70 years of age. I looked at him, I've been 70 a few years already. So I thought to myself, at my age, either you're not standing upright, lo aleinu, or you're writing your memoirs. We're all in the same boat. But anyway, on the basis of Rabbi Riskin's talk in his book, which sets the stage for mine, all night I kept on thinking what I would say when we launched the book of that, the big book launch in the Great Synagogue, and I wrote it out this morning. So I'm Baruch Hashem, Machadesh, and inside God should give strength. But today's shiur is very fascinating, and I don't know how far I can reach. I have a sefer prepared that's even more fascinating, but I have to finish what I want to do first today. Now, just to remind you, last week, We spent a lot of time on the B'Samim Rosh, and so-called, in the name of Rishonim, how we threw out the power of a Beit Din to execute, to punish, and mamish, this is totally against the Rishonim, totally against the early Achronim, but it's part of modern life. And it's just amazing the insight that this man had long before Napoleon. And you all understand what we're talking about. You can't go around executing Jews today if you live in the big Western world. In the state of Israel as well, it's caught up, as we mentioned last week, we don't execute. There are only two crimes, basically, which execution applies. One is crimes against the Jewish people, that's why Eichmann was executed, or a traitor to the state of Israel. And it's very hard today, if you're going to say someone's a traitor, all I can tell you, everyone calls the other one a traitor. So I'd hate to think, you understand, you ask Rav Kefet who the traitors are, the professors at Hebrew U, at Tel Aviv U, at Beersheva U, at Haifa U, who go all over the world, standing at the forefront of the boycott of Israel. I mean, you just think, in England now, there was an official complaint to Israel from the Jews there that two professors led the public attack on Israel, and two professors spoke on TV, boycott Israel. So if they're traitors, who isn't a traitor? But you'll ask a leftist, who's a traitor? Someone who lives in Hebron, Kiryat Arba. And a professor at Hebrew U a number of years ago stated in public we should shoot all the people living in Kiryat Arba, Hebron. So if that isn't a trade, I don't know who, but you see, he looks at it that we're traded from his point of view. So thank God we don't give a death penalty halacha l'maisa in Israel if a person is a bogeid. I'll only quote to you what I said the Sunday after the Rabin assassination. And a lot of people tell me they quoted him until today. You understand, it was a terror. I can't start to tell you the harm it did to people like us in Israel with that assassination, Yigal Amir assassinating Yitzhak Rabin. Oh, God. Anyway, I told my students, I said, look, we're all opinionated, we all have viewpoints, but Torah, the way Chazal set us up, it's very simple to let out your anger. All you have to do is concentrate in Lamal Shinim, Alti Tikva. When you finish Monesre, it's in God's hands, not you. That's the way it has to be. So many times I've davened and I've been so angry and I just finished hearing the news. So Lamal Shinim, Alti Tikva. That's the bracha. What do you want out of me? Chazal were metaken the bracha. Who are they metaken it for? They were metaken it for Jews like us. I don't want to go into details now. You know, the whole Gemara, why Shmuel HaKatan, why they went to him, the Reb Dashan died it. But halacha l'maisa, all of us said, l'mal shinin malti tikva. L'mal shinin malti tikva is simply about Jews. So we don't apply a death penalty. And thank God, if you take my advice and you're angry at someone, daven with kavana, and I always say, when you see a Jew saying l'mal shinim with more kavana than any other bracha, you know that we're in trouble, if you understand what I'm saying. Okay, you need a little maturity to appreciate my sense of humor, but believe me, I hit the nail on the head now. Okay, but it's an emeritic tshuva, the chutzpah, to do away with the rishonim and the achronim, and he gets away with it. All right, now we want to deal with suicide. What's fascinating about this tshuva, it was left out of the reprinted edition in 18, what was it, I gave you the date, I think it was 1881, when they reprinted for the second time the Besamim Rosh, this tshuva was one of two tshuvas left out. And you know what's amazing about this tshuva? That halacha l'maisa today, everyone follows the tshuva from people in the Wayu world, the people in the Panovich world, the people in the Mechazarav world, the people in the Satma world. And this case, the Besamim Rosh hit the nail on the head, and he was way ahead of everyone else's thinking. And of course, by the way, I don't know if I corrected myself. I spoke last week, I said Mount Freedom. What was the name of the community? I corrected myself, I think, on last Monday. Woodburn.
Woodbine.
I got confused between two communities that I used to visit my friends from the rabbinate, and it was Woodbine. And if you can check it out in the Encyclopedia Judaica, it's just what I said. It was an Orthodox community with an Orthodox shul, with an Orthodox cemetery, and the suicides were buried outside the cemetery. Now, let me read you the Rambam first. And of course, like you, I'm not going backwards. I'm just reading the Rambam, but every Rambam, 98% of the Rambam is from a Gemara, the Babli, or at times the Yerushalmi. So if you look into the Rambam, Hilchot Avel, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud, Kol HaPoshin Midak Et Sibur. V'chim Anashim Shepaku O HaMitzvot Mi'al Tzavarein, V'ein Nechlon B'Klal Yisrael B'Asiyah P'Mitzvot, V'Kavet HaMoadot V'Yeshivat Batei, and he said the Batei Medrashat, Harehim kevenei chorem latzman kusha umat v'chein haminim hamishumadim hamaisrim kol elu ein mitablim aleichem. You are not obligated to mourn for Jews who have separated themselves from Klal Yisrael. Now the Rambam's definition here is very fascinating. We'll come to it in our Monday class in a similar Rambam in Hilchot Shuva. But you see, it doesn't just mean someone who doesn't observe mitzvot. If you separate yourself from Klal Yisrael, you know, they're Jews, and I see this all over the world. I saw it in Russia. I couldn't believe it, with a handful of Jews left in the 1980s who were observant, there were Jews who would daven b'yechidut rather than go to the local shul. They were mad, they were angry. I have seen this all over the world. Hilchot Avel Perek Aleph Halacha Yud.
Where is it in Hilchos Tshuva?
In Hilchos Tshuva, it's Perek Gimel Halacha Yud Aleph. But we'll come to it on a Monday morning, Aldan, because I need it. It's a very important concept. But here I just needed, from the point of view, there's no din of aveilut. This Jew, a parish minat sibur, is considered chutz l'tchum, like he's automatically excommunicated by his very actions. He puts himself beyond the pale.
But he doesn't say you bury him separate.
No, not to say that.
He just says we don't mourn.
We don't mourn. V'chein haminim v'amushumadim meisvrim. All right, all of these. What do you do? Alachaychem v'shakroim lovshim levanim. They dress in white, not in black. Mitatfim levanim v'yochlim v'shalpim v'smeichim she'avdu sanav shel hakadosh baruch hu. All right, what a halacha. You have to be happy. Enemies of God have disappeared. Now, I want to ask you. The family has to be happy. This is the Rambam Paskaling la halacha. Tell me, when did this come up in Israel? In the last few years, this was front page news. No? Gentlemen, Panovich Yeshiva, you think only YU has turned out the Apikasim? Believe me, only Lakewood has turned out. Panovich and Chevron have their share too. Percentage wise, I'm willing to bet it's larger than the YU Renegades. But that something has to be researched. You have to prove it. I don't know if it can be proven. But two brothers studied in Panovich from a very Litvish family. One of them went on to become a very famous Mashkiach. He is well known today. Harav Dan Segel. I make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant cast for the wise. Adam, you've heard the name? Baruch Hashem. So the Rebbe knows what he's saying, thank God. Nu Yitzchak, who is his brother? Ephraim Segel, a tremendous TV personality. Ephraim Segel, what can I tell you? Caught up in the Israeli I don't want to say the word majority, but the entertainment world, the newspapers. If you read the Israeli newspapers, they are so anti the government. It's hard to believe what's going on. You read Judea, you read Marib. They would love to see riots in the street here, like in Egypt. And it hurts them that the Jews are not rioting. Adishim. What's the word in English? Indifferent. Very good. Adishim. You know you lived in Israel too long when you know the word in Hebrew and not in English. So Ephraim Segel died. It's within the last two or three years. And his brother went to Rav Yashiv, and Rav Yashiv read this Rambam to him, and paskim la halacha not to sit Shiva for his brother. I need not tell you, the public thoroughfare had a field day with this. Michael, I agree with you. I can just tell you in advance that I'm not here to lehefech. I totally, completely agree. Rebbeinu Shloim, how do you paskin a person who learned in Panovich is a meshumad, is an apikores? Maybe he was. Believe me.
The implications in this is that through people wouldn't say.
The implications, Bizman Hazer, open up. Bizman Hazer, open up the Chazon Ish and Hilchot Shchiter. I've quoted it many times, right at the end of Siman Bet. And the Chazon Ish says clearly, there's no dim apikoros, but Zman Hazeh. How can you say an apikoros after the Holocaust? There's no clear hashgacha gluya. All right, and it's much more than that, because it's a tinuk shenishba, and you know you're raised in the public thoroughfare, ger v'toshav enochi imachem, you're raised among the toshavim, the New York Times, the internet, the bloggers. It's a small world today, a global village. So I would chas v'chalila not passing your submission shiva. Anyway, halacha yud aleph, hamaved atzmo ledat, ein mitnaskini mo lechol davar, lo mitablim alav, lo maspidim oto. almost nothing whatsoever. All you do, the Rambam says, Abalom Dimabla Bishuvav Romimalav Bichat Aveilim Vukhodaba Shahu Kavod Lechayim. What you do is, if the family is very upset, the man committed suicide, he was not an apikoros. I told you, I know three cases of suicide within a few months of each other, or two were in a few weeks of each other, the other one was a few years later. And believe me, all three people committed suicide with kippah on, one may have had a black hat on. God have mercy. And so you feel very bad, so you do lekavod dechayim, you do nicham avel. Then the Rambam says, Ezehu hamabed atzmo ledat. How do you know it's suicide? Lo shelaleg rosh hagag v'nafalu meit. Ela ha'omer hareini olele rosh hagag v'ra'oto shelah miyad derech kas oshachaya meitza v'nafal v'meit. It's a very insightful Rambam. And any of you who get involved in police work, forensic work, this is why when you find a body, let's say someone dies at home, someone dies in a hotel, if no one was with the person at the time of death, it always becomes a police matter. And generally speaking, they will do an autopsy to ascertain there was no foul play. Because a person dies, you have to know why. You have to know, was he murdered, did he commit suicide, or did he die of natural causes? You all know in New York that many times they're very sensitive to the Torah Jews, and when a person dies, they will not do an autopsy, but they will speak with people who know him to be sure that we can be reasonably certain it was a natural death. And I told you, one of the cases that I had was in my building, and it was around Yom HaTzmut. Remember what I told you? It was a different Israel then, 1978, I believe. And this whole area was not built up yet. There was nothing here. And the Israeli army was camping out here, thousands upon thousands of soldiers, getting ready for, I think they had a parade and a tekkes, whatever they had. I think planes flew over, paratroopers jumped out of the planes. There was a whole tekkes on Yom HaTzmut right in this area. And the police were chayshish that it was Arab terrorism. Only when I told them that the man had suffered from depression and his wife brought the pills, and I told them exactly what happened in the school in which we taught together, they released the body for burial. And this is the Rambam, that if a person, you find the person dead, he went up to the roof. No, you go up to the roof, you fall down, it doesn't mean you committed suicide. A guy crashed his car into a wall, it doesn't mean he committed suicide. But if the person said to his friends, I'm going up to the roof to jump, and you saw he was angry, he was upset, he was depressed, meitzah, then he is considered a suicide, and all the restrictions apply. And what Yitzchak referred to with the burial, over the years we developed the custom, you don't bury a suicide with the other Jews. It goes back to a whole sugya in Sanhedrin, Ein kovrim rishayim etzol tzaddikim. You all know that for the Dalet mitot beitin, some of the mitot were considered more severe, and if someone suffered a more severe punishment, he was not buried next to those who suffered a more lenient punishment. And this is why until today, we're makpid in cemeteries, you'll see there cemeteries that have Shemesh Shabbos sections. In America, you'll see that too, because you don't want to be buried next to a Machalos Shabbos. All right. The Gemara is in... I have to look it up exactly, but you can find it very easily by working your way backwards from Hilchot Sanhedrin, and you'll see where it talks about Dalet Mitot Beitin. It talks about Kfura. I can look it up in a minute, but I don't want to take time now. Ask me after class, I'll tell you tomorrow. Now, anyway... This is a whole sugya in Sanhedrin, and that's the basis why suicides, prostitutes, murderers, criminals were buried outside the cemetery. There's another reason why, because we were once a very tight-knit community. And the concept of Shanda Fada Goyim, that it's embarrassing for us in front of the Gentiles to misbehave, we didn't want these people to be buried with the other Jews. I have to say that, unfortunately, this concept doesn't exist today, and we have very fine Jews who are robbers, thieves, rapists, seducers. I don't want to go on, and these Jews can all have long beards and payas and big kippot, and it's a shanda for a shanda for the Ribbono Shel Olam they don't worry about. So they certainly are not going to worry about a shanda for the goyim. But at one time, we were very sensitive to that concept. In the state of Israel, obviously, a shanda for the goyim doesn't play a role, and that was Chaim Nachman Bialik's, in my opinion, stupid comment. The famous story when they caught the first crook in Tel Aviv, so people were shocked that a Jewish man could rob from other Jews. They used to say about Yerushalayim before the state was founded and you had the big aliyah, many immigrants among them, poverty-stricken people, that you could leave your suitcase on the street and you'd find it exactly where you left it a day or two later. So Bialik made the comment, Tzrichim levareich shechiyonu. You know, he was a wise guy. So they asked Bialik, Maha pshat levareich shechiyonu? He said, thank God a Jew is caught robbing and the Jewish community doesn't suffer. The goyim are not saying the Jews are terrible. Death to the Jews. We caught a Jew robbing. He'll be punished. The community doesn't have to suffer. Rakefet would say, we caught a Jew robbing in the state of Israel, alat mata kodesh. We have to make a bracha, baruch dayan ha'emet, that we have succumbed and fallen so low that a Jew can rob. And all of you know, just a week ago, Yitzhak, remember the picture you showed me? Yeshiva boys, black pants, white shirts, black hats, went to Italy, davened in the shul. Would you imagine that young people from Jerusalem dressed like this are thieves? And they robbed when the Balabatim walked out. They robbed all the gold and silver and they try to sell it in Jerusalem. Thank God it's a small world today. The people in Milan, am I right? It was Milan, Italy, tipped off the police here, the people here, and the person they were trying to sell it to recognized immediately it was robbed. They called the police in, went through with the deal, and the minute the money exchanged hands, they pounced on them. I'm a terrible person. I would take these four guys and I'd put them in solitary confinement for 7 years. That's what I would do. But you know, it's justice here. They'll get away with 3 years. They'll be sitting and learning in Tel Amasiyahu with the Bavim El Abenko. Oh my gosh. It's good to go to jail in Israel. That's all I can say. Now, you know, I know people sitting in jail, they're boasting to me that they're going through two different Masechtet Be'ilim. Now, this was the question, Shin Mem He in the Besamim Rosh, and he describes this person who was impoverished. His description, Chaseh Lechem V'Chashuv Sheit. I don't want to translate what the second part means. It simply means he had to walk around semi-nude because he had no money. All right? Now, I don't have to tell you again, you fellas don't know what it means to... We'll talk about this in the Monday class when we deal with the Holocaust. But you don't know what it means not to have money for the basic necessities of life. Thank God, none of you have ever lacked for food. You know what it's like to lack for food? How it takes away your human dignity? You just think on a fast day, not on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, I don't know about you, but you're busy davening. I know on Yom Kippur I have an easy fast. Tisha B'Av, I'm generally in New York City, it's a long day, how much kinas can you say? And the afternoon, and you're dreaming of a cup of coffee, and your whole mind is preoccupied. You got to switch out of it. When we were kids, on Tisha B'Av, I hate to admit it, but our Tisha B'Av was spent in the afternoon watching a New York Yankee game, a Brooklyn Dodger game. You had to get your mind off the fast, or you were just dreaming of food, and more food. But all right, today it's a different ballpark, so I devoted myself to the OU fabulous edition of the keynote with the Rav's commentary on Tisha B'Av. But you just think for a minute, if you don't have food, all you're thinking about is food, you don't have clothes. Think for a minute the lack of dignity if you had to walk around half naked. Rabbi Riskin spoke about that last night. The guy, if you read his book, and I recommend it to you, the guy sitting next to him on the plane who was half naked, who that guy turns out to be. And you understand, it's a lack of dignity. Rabbi Riskin looked at this guy, he turned away, he said, "Oy vey, who am I sitting next to? What do we have in common? Who can I talk to?" And Riskin wanted to have nothing to do with him. And then this guy watches Rabbi Riskin, and they didn't have kosher food for him. He had been put on the plane at the last minute. He was shifted from a different flight. And the guy watches, all he has for breakfast is orange juice. So when it comes time for lunch, he says, "You Orthodox Jew," he says to him, "take a regular meal. When they give it out, I'll take the meat and I'll give you my vegetables. You'll have a lunch of vegetables instead of four glasses of juice, and I'll have two pieces of rice hamburger sandwiches." And they got to talk, and it turned out to be a very fascinating. It turned out that this person was the son of a bishop, and he was the head of a football team, and he was supposed to have been in business class, and they bumped him, and they were going to give him a refund because it was oversubscribed business class, and he was dressed, you know, a football player, basketball player, whatever, and tattooed. And he says to Rabbi Riskin, when they strike up a conversation, "I haven't spoken to my father for 10 years. I hate my father. He had time for everyone except his own son." My wife gives me a shtup. She says, "Nu, who said that?" "That was Rabbi Rebel's son. Mrs. Rebel told me Norman and Herschel. Norman once hysterically cried out to his father, 'You had time for everyone's sons except your own.'" And Rabbi Riskin explained to him what it means to be a clergyman, what he's going through, that he's flying out to the coast, he's leaving his family, leaving his young children, and he says they're going to resent that. "I know they're going to resent it, but I have a calling, I have to answer. There's a reason. Your father was caught between two worlds, his own little world and the world which he wanted to improve and inspire." And by the end of the flight, this gentleman says to the good rabbi, "I'm calling my father, and I'm going to make up with him, and God put us together on this flight." That's a classic Rabbi Riskin story. I want to tell you, no one can tell a story like Rabbi Riskin, okay? I sign on the dotted line. Anyway, you can imagine who this person is. No food, no clothes, and he says publicly, "I'm sick and tired of living like that judge last week, the tragedy in Jerusalem, Ben-Attar," and he commits suicide. And now the family asks, "Can you mourn him? Can you cry for him? What's his status?" And many people say, "He's a murderer. He murdered himself. Look up the Rambam. There's no Avelut. Ain't it a blimalov? Ma beidat a smaller dot." And this is what the people say to this family. His tshuva is fascinating. He raises the issue of Shaul HaMelech. Remember how many shayurim we spent on Shaul HaMelech? Who can give me the rubric where Shaul HaMelech comes in to Everyone in this class, if you haven't studied the issue, your teachers have sinned against you. Yosef, when I give you the number 93, what does that mean? That, you see how brilliant Yosef is? He's going to be a great rabbi, a great Talmud Chacham. 93 Beis Yaakov girls. There's a Rechov Hatzadi Gimel in Petach Tikva. Now, I know Rakefet gave so many shurim. Did it happen? Didn't it happen? I want to tell you something in the name of the Rub, and you might as well hear it now and apply it the rest of your lives. Many of the stories about Gedolei Yisrael may or may not be true. They're apocryphal. Many. But you know, the Jews believe the stories. It shows you how we thought of Gedolei Yisrael. We held them in the highest esteem. And we were willing to believe any story. And the Rav said, it's not important whether it happened or not. What's important is that Klal Yisrael visualized these great Rabbanim in this light. Gentlemen, I don't know whether the 93 girls happened or didn't happen. All of you are aware of Rabbi J.J. Shechter's famous article. All of you are aware of the Machloket didn't. Excuse me?
It's
more than an article. It's a monograph, absolutely. But I want to tell you one thing. Klal Yisrael believed it happened. It could have happened. The girls were on that level. This is Beis Yaakov, and this is Chinuch Torani. It's not, I use Beis Yaakov as a generic term. Believe me, I look at the Ulpana girls that we're raising in the state of Israel. It's beyond words the level of dedication this youth has today. I stand in awe of the children that are being raised here in these circles, and I know many of them intimately. I don't say everyone is a tzaddik, but the level of tzidkut, the percentage, is overwhelming. Gentlemen, were the Beis Yaakov girls permitted to commit suicide? Good luck, Mendel. Everything should be okay. You have a good doctor and everything for the...
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. They're good doctors, so you just have to discover and have... And then there are good doctors. The level of medicine is as good as anywhere in the Western world. Overall, in some levels it's better, some levels slightly less. But doctors per se, I'm willing to bet it's above average compared to England, Canada, and even the United States. Anyway, coming back here, were they permitted to commit suicide? The girls were told that a day later, the Gestapo was coming in to visit them. And these 93 girls committed suicide. What is the source to permit it? Shaul HaMelech, right or wrong? Shaul HaMelech committed suicide. I don't have to tell you. The source for Shaul HaMelech, Shmuel Bet, Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, committed suicide. Shemi Yit Kalalupo, what does it mean? So much has been written. But you see that at times, suicide is permissible. We can't take the suffering. Shaul HaMelech was frightened. They kill him 1,000 different ways. They cut his body to pieces. They would torture him, disgrace him. Well, it could be. That's a big source. If you can't take the suffering, if you can't take the starvation, the privation, the shame, maybe Shaul HaMelech is the example to follow. Nachum, I'm saying it popularly. No, it's every word I'm saying is a machlokes.
Sure, and
yeah.
If something is a Yehari Gal Yavar, isn't that essentially, even if it's passively committing suicide?
But Yehari Gal was Kiddush Hashem.
Right, so these girls, I mean... Really,
that's a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem.
Right, so these girls, I mean, wouldn't that...
First of all, with a woman, we raise the whole issue. What you heard, Ve'al Yava, Esther Kaka Oilam Haita. The Gemara, what is it? That's the Gemara Sanhedrin. It's Sanhedrin Memdalit. What do you mean politically not correct? We're trying to save women from committing suicide. You're telling me politically not correct. A rapist, you're allowed to shoot, kill him, but the woman, you don't. The woman doesn't have to give her life. Could very well be as the Kakola might come.
You brought us a Rambam that if a person.
I know.
Shouldn't do it.
Right, right. And that's a Rishonim. The Rambam and many other Rishonim differ with them. It's a Machlokes Rishonim. But what I'm trying to say is, look what he's trying to do here. He's trying to find, in other words, a justification why you shouldn't apply strictures against the suicide. You wouldn't apply strictures against Shaul HaMelech, right or wrong? They gave him covered b'moto. He was not considered a suicide. The medrash, I mean, everyone has to deal with Shaul HaMelech. And you look into the Bereshit Rabbah, but not Shaul HaMelech. This is a tremendous question. How could he commit suicide? And people like this can't. And you see that he's being melamed schot, that a person who commits suicide is doing it, he is afraid, he's frightened, he's fearful, he's not in control of his senses, he's sick, he's demented. They just arrested someone in Jerusalem for murder or something. And again, they say right away they're giving him over to psychologists to see if he knows what he's doing, if he's fit to stand trial. And here you have the B'Samim Rosh alluding to it 220 years ago. So what is suicide? And here he comes to a thought that circulates since the Greeks introduced this idea. Suicide is philosophical suicide. What does that mean? That you want to free the soul from the body. This is suicide. When a person says, Halavai, I should be dead. What do I need this body for? What an ugly, terrible body. I have to feed it. I have to clothe it. It runs after a woman. That's a disgrace. That's a annihilation of God's creation. God created us to have a body. Put a soul into the body. God created us to have Gashmiyot. How did Socrates look at it? Suicide, the ultimate, most beautiful, most dignifying act, you free the soul from the earthly body. This is suicide. Avo, b'tzarat nafsho, ki lo yachol sa'et, he can't bear the suffering, ein safek. She'ein b'zeh shum isur. You hear those words? The B'Samim Rosh speaking in the name of the Rosh. There's no prohibition whatsoever. And he ends off the tshuva as only a Rishon would end it off. V'atem asu lani hazeh k'derech shenohagim b'chol Yisrael. But two, lomidei, I don't have to say another word. Treat him like any other Jew. Give him the covered of a human being, of human dignity. It's an unbelievable tshuva. In the modern world today, when anyone commits suicide, you ask a rabbi, how do I deal with this suicide? The rabbi will ask you, was he depressed? Did he have mental problems? Was he jilted by his girlfriend? Did his children leave home and then refuse to speak to him? I have seen so many cases in life. And sometimes I shiver and shake because I fear for suicide. I know people, again, I don't want to mention names, but I know people who came in Aliyah. And Aliyah, you know, when you come as a kid in your 20s, it's a different ballpark. when you've studied here and lived here and you know the mentality, it's a different ballpark. Some people came in their 40s, 50s, and suddenly they died. Never could get a clear answer. Why? How? Big, fine, Talmidei Chachamim. But you know what it means? Person who had prestige in America, and here he's a nobody. You know what it means? A 50-year-old person is looking at me, I'm a kid in BMT, I was in my early 30s, tearing up the world, and he's just lost his job. All his self-respect is gone. We will always paskin. He's not a suicide. He was sick. He didn't know what he was doing. I don't know. Does anyone commit suicide today and leave a note? I'm the happiest person in the world to follow the example of the great Greek philosophers to take my beautiful soul out of this terrible earthly temporal body. If anyone talks like that, he's a suicide. Outside of that, so I have to tell you, they didn't reproduce this B'Samim Rosh. It's amazing. And yet the halacha is like him here. You know why they didn't reproduce it? Because you're dealing with 130 years ago, the 1880s. You're caught up in this tremendous conflict. By the 1880s, millions of Jews are outside the ghetto. They are fighting a battle of assimilation, of survival, of Judaism, and you have suicides. Couldn't make our peace with it. Today, thank God, I would say, again, it has to be checked if any research was ever done. Today already, I think there are a lot less suicides. We know how to live outside the ghetto. The conflict is not as great. Unfortunately, if you want to leave Torah, you can walk away. What can I tell you? Many a Satmar walked away. Many a Gera walked away. Many a Lakewood guy walked away. Many a Torah Vedas guy walked away. Many a YU guy walked away. You're not fenced in. You don't have to commit suicide. But someone like the B'Samim Rosh, he was fenced in. In the 1880s, he was still semi-fenced in. Today, fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not saying it's the ideal, but anyone can pick up and walk away. And I can give you Israeli politicians, you have no idea. Dalia Itzik, who is Speaker of the Knesset, she went to Rothschild. The person who owns the Be'er Sheva football team is a graduate of Amalia, a few blocks from here. She's married to Nir Barkat's brother, also a multimillionaire, self-made. I don't know, are they from? I don't know. Halavai, I said to my daughter, Dalia Itzik is not Shomeret Shabbos. My daughter says, Abba, what are you, naive? I don't know. I can't believe a girl who went to Rothschild, raised in the Katamonim, shouldn't be Shomeret Shabbos. Ugh. But at least today, you don't have to commit suicide. We can be more generous in our psak and hope we can inspire. Anyway, this is the tshuva. It is extremely fascinating. And here I have to say, the halacha today is like the B'Samim Rosh. Yes, who wanted to ask? Ephraim?
I didn't understand the whole idea. So Rav Soloveitchik said that the stories about tzaddikim are might be not true.
Even if they're not true, the fact that you and I believe it shows what Klal Yisrael thought about that tzaddikim. You follow? In other words, it shows our love for tzaddikim, our faith in tzaddikim. It shows how great they were that we can tell these stories about them. Okay?
So, yeah.
Do you understand that, Ephraim?
Yeah. Benny Lau, his firm, he's writing on the Chachamim.
Yeah.
I think with Professor Gaffney, in all his speeches, a lot of these things never really happened. So he said that's not the point. The point is that the Gemara says they happen. So it shows the Gemara.
I daven every morning. I daven every Shacharis. All week I daven with Yeshaya Gaffney. I know Benny Lau too. I quote him in my new book. Hold on 1 second. What's your name?
Rafi.
Rafi what?
Abraham.
Yeah, you wanted to ask something.
You answered it.
Okay? Yeah.
I understand John? the last thing with regards to the issue that we can't go around killing people because our judge said that we can, but the secular court say we can't, because that's going to cause a whole riot. But with regards to this B'Tzav Rosh, it's hard for me to understand why it's accepted because it's not imposed by the secular society that we should be doing something.
No, it's not that it's accepted. But if someone commits suicide, we're not going to paskin you. You can't bury him and you can't mourn for him. You follow?
Right, but he's changing the previous approach of what suicide was. I don't understand why we're paskin like him in this.
Because we all know psychology today. And psychology has changed our whole concept. When a person commits suicide, he's lav badat, he's a shelter. His inner body, his inner mind is tortured. If he's a shelter, you can't hold him responsible. This is what I just said, how the police said they're giving this murderer, if I'm not mistaken, it's a murderer, that they gave him over to the psychologist to see whether he knows what he's doing, whether they can put him on trial. The same thing in America. How many murderers were put in mental institutions rather than put on trial?
Right, Arizona,
the same thing with the Summer Roach over the authority of Mendel Rishon. No, but the Summer Roach is not his authority. What's amazing here is that by the year 2011, most 99% of Achronim agree with him. Because, as I said, psychology has opened a Pandora's box. Okay,
it's considered a mental illness, just like a person who had a kidney failure.
Correct.
Poor man had a mental illness.
Correct.
He did believe in the Greek philosophers, which was really interesting.
He's what? What?
He's really Christian if he really believes in the Greek philosophical ideas.
Yeah, no.
That's more Christian than Jewish.
But the Greek philosophers, you understand, the people knew this. I don't know how much they knew of Christian theology. But Greek theology, Aristotle HaKadosh, the Rishonim are filled with references to them. So you see it filtered down. But it's a fascinating tshuva, and Josh, understand me what I'm saying? It's not that we pass on like the B'Tzav Rosh. It's that the thoughts that he has expressed today, all the Achronim say it 100%. I've yet to hear of a suicide who was not buried properly and they didn't mourn for it. I've yet to hear of such a case, okay? And I'm talking right-wing, centrist, left-wing, the whole gamut of contemporary Torah life. No, he died a natural death, but he was a mishumat, he was an apikores, call him what you wish. It was an unbelievable psak. And it caused so much enmity. Oh, what went on in the press. And frankly, I can't understand it, because that's going against the Chazon Ish. How can you call a Panovich a graduate? That Ephraim should have gone to Yeshiva University. He might have been better off. You understand what I'm saying? He was seeking more than just Torah learning. And he was in the wrong place. And the result was he became a chiloni. And he was a well-known TV newscaster, analyst. He was a TV personality, Ephraim Segal. And his brother did not sit shiva for him. It was a sight of... I wouldn't paskin that way. But
do you know who did paskin
that way? Excuse me?
Do we know who paskin that
way? Rabbi Yashiv, yeah. We went to Rabbi Yashiv, yeah.
If you think it for, like, during World War II, I remember there was this case, somebody ended up in London, and he was trying to draw attention to what was going on, nobody was listening to him, so he killed himself. And
you're talking about a Jew?
Yeah, he's a prominent, like, a representative in the Jewish Agency or something, and he said, like, he hopes it will draw attention. It's like these Buddhists who set themselves on fire.
Fire, no.
So
yeah. I don't know if you come up with a positive reason, you can sort of justify. But was this during the Holocaust?
Yeah.
I never heard of such a case.
It's in
news to me. That's
so
all I can say.
There was a guy who was the head of one of the ghettos.
No, okay, that's a different story. No, that's a different story.
This guy was in England.
In England, I never heard of the case, but I'm sure the Rabbanim paskened he was not a suicide.
He was head of the Jewish community in Poland. He was head of the Polish Jewish community.
In England, the exile. You don't know the name, all right? It can be checked out, but I never heard. I know in the Holocaust, of course, people in the Judenrat committed suicide because they saw what they were being used for. Okay, now I
also, for example, you mentioned, let's say a person has secrets, and he knows he's going to be
right. Of course, we mentioned that. Well, yeah, of course, he's allowed to commit suicide, and we know that among Israelis who fell into capture, they committed suicide. That is absolutely true. They're viewed as giborim because they felt that if they would get the information out of them, it would kill many, many, many Jews. Listen, this is Roy Klein, who jumped on the grenade and killed himself, saving all the soldiers around him.
Malcolm just mentioned, like, Sarah Aronson.
Right, right. Lobogadity. There's the famous case in Syria where and they got back, they found Lobogadity. God have mercy. Now, how many of you, this is amazing, what he picks on a few tshuvot later. We're now dealing with Shin Mem Chet, a few tshuvot later. And this is just amazing. How many of you have been in Israel for Pesach? Tell me, what is the most frustrating part of life in Israel on Pesach? Of course, all the Sfadim are eating legumes, having a ball, and here we are, looking at labels, suffering, and it is a terrible, terrible problem. You see the advertisements for the hotels, none kitniyot. They're letting you know you can come, there are no kitniyot, you don't have to worry. Now, what makes the problem so difficult is that it's an open gemara that kitniyot, rice is not machmitz. It's not fermentation. It's chametz. Chametz is a halachic concept unto itself. It's not to be understood as fermentation, because fermentation, you can take grapes and you know, what did they, leave them in water and there's fermentation. You put rice and boil it, there's fermentation, but that's not chametz. It's an open gemara. Vegetables, legumes. Who ever heard of legumes being chametz? What happened here? And I don't know why, but at this point when we're coming out of the ghetto, it greatly troubled some of the rabbanim. It could be that Jews started to travel. See, I again, this has to be researched in secular literature. In the 1700s, did people start to travel more? And if they started to travel more, it will explain that Ashkenazic Jews met up with Sephardic Jews. Pesach come. Well, Amsterdam is one example, but German Jews met the Ashkenaz Jews in Amsterdam, in London, the Sephardic Jews, I should say, in London, in Amsterdam, and comes Pesach, and the Jew whose Ashkenaz is suffering, and the Jew whose Sephardi is eating like a king, rice, beans, etc. Now, this problem is further compounded with what I've mentioned many times, so without understanding it, you can't really grasp the depth of the problem. The more matzah they had to bake, the more chametz there was. The reason is very simple. If any of you have gone to a hand matzah factory, and you've gone to a machine matzah factory, you tell me which is the more kosher matzah. Right? There's no question. I heard this from the Rav, but I saw it with my own eyes. There's no question that the machine matzah is better. The only problem with machine matzah is the question for shmura matzah when you need a lishma. Does the machine create lishma? In other words, is it sufficient that a Jew turns the machine on, and when he turns it on, he says l'shem matzah mitzvah. But if you take the point of view that turning on the machine is sufficient to create l'shma, like the Ashkenazim Paskin, it's sufficient to create Bishul Yisrael. You know, just think for a minute, where you have a Oyu Hashgacha, so the Mashgiach will turn the light on, let's say, the pilot light at 10 o'clock in the morning, and until 1 after midnight, everyone is cooking, and the basis of the mashgiach who turned the pilot light on, it is considered Bishul Yisrael. Sfaradim have a bigger problem, you know. There, the mechaber is more machmir, and that's one of the few places where the mechaber is more machmir than the Ashkenazic practice. But when it comes to matzah, it's the only shaila. When it comes to machines, and particularly today, if you would see what a modern matzah factory is like, what they have invented, what they can do, there's no question. In an 18-minute hand shmura place, they're yelling, "Nemarois, no, dotten in dotten dotten is that no is that dotten dotten steht noch a stickel matzah, and move it out, get it out, move it around." And then they have to check if the matzah blew up, the choshish for chametz, if it's, in the Hebrew we use the word nafuach. How would you say that in English? It's inflated. What's the word?
Swollen,
but it doesn't make sense in English. Nafuach means, yeah, swollen.
Blown up, puffed up,
inflated, aerated. And they have to check. So there was a real fear. A person has to eat. You have to fill your stomach up. No, if you don't eat beans and you don't eat rice, you're going to need more matzah. The more matzah, the more chametz. Now, I don't have to tell you, it's well known, the Chacham Tzvi, who was, may believe he was a Sfardi, but he was an Ashkenazi Tahar. But notice he called himself Chacham Tzvi. He was the father of Reb Yaakov Emden. No one in the world will claim that Reb Yaakov Emden was a Sfardi. And they cried bitterly, "Halavai, we could abolish the concept of kidneyot." What's more important is, until today, no Ashkenazi Talmud Chacham can tell us for sure why we don't use kidney yot. There are theories on top of theories, but we don't know for sure. One theory, which to me makes the most sense from my experience in the Israeli army in cleaning rice, is that the wind would blow wheat around, and you might find a drop of wheat, a grain of wheat, in the corn, in the peas, what you harvest from a different part of the field. Of course, there would be a very easy solution if this was the problem. Solution, no, you tell me. You bake it, you make it before Pesach. If you do that, it's batul b'shishim. The halach of mashahu is only on Pesach proper. That's why in the army, when they still served rice, we would check it, cook it, and freeze it. If you use it on Pesach, no problem. Batul b'shishim. Well, whoever wanted, yeah. That's the problem. It was in the kitchen. Now they don't serve rice anymore. For whatever the reasons are, there's so many Ashkenazim. One time the Sfardim dominated the army. Today, with the Russian emigration and all the Anglos and the French Ashkenazim, evidently it caused too much of a, you know, a Jew who's not used to seeing rice and beans on Pesach, he doesn't want to eat in the kitchen. So today the army no longer serves rice. I don't know what they use as a filler, probably potatoes, but it's a problem because people have to eat, soldiers have to eat. That's one theory. A second theory that you'll see widely in all the books that write about kidneyot, that they used to make bread out of beans. And they were worried if you allow people to use corn flour, bean flour, they'll use regular flour. And that was why Jews started the minhag of not eating kidneyot. All right, that's a very weak theory, but that's one of the theories given. We do not know for sure. We don't even know when the minhag began. The earliest references, you find the trace of it in the early Rishonim, but only a trace. The first real references are in the latter Rishonim, Ashkenaz. And we're not sure why it began. I don't have to tell you, in modern times, this became a tremendous issue with the oils. What about the oil of the legumes? And the last 130 years, I would say, a world of tshuva has been written on this problem. Poland, parts of Germany, they did use oil, derivatives. Lithuania was much more machmir. Chabad always used peanut oil. They considered peanuts as not being legumes. The question of oil continues until today. The only oil that has no detractors whatsoever is olive oil. The problem with olive oil is twofold. It leaves an aftertaste, and it's very high in calories. So in our society, where everyone is calorie conscious, olive oil presents a problem. Then, of course, you have canola oil. Logically speaking, canola oil is not kidney yet, because no one knew about canola seeds, no one used it. This is a modern product. How can it be kidney yet? Sunflower seeds, I understand Rabbi Lichtenstein also felt it wasn't made kidney yet. There's a world written on this topic. Other people use regular vegetable oil because they feel that the gezeira or the minhag was only on the product per se, but not on the derivative, not what's called made kidney yet. They came up in Israel for a number of years with a palm oil and a palm oil margarine, but they took that off the market because it's considered the worst type of oil for the arteries, for creating terrible problems with the heart system, with the circulatory system. So it's a terrible, terrible situation on Pesach with kidney yet. And so much has been written. What happens if Nachum Lamb marries a Sfardiyah and he goes to his in-law's home and they serve him rice? What happens if Adam Rosenberg picks up a Chaymaniyah and here he is in his in-law's home, rice and beans, the works and the Kalim is the right? They say to him, fine, Danny, they say to him, you don't have to eat the rice. Can you use the Kalim? I don't have to tell you how much has been written on this topic. Anyone who's a little left of center, I knew great Rabbanim, big Talmidei Chachamim, that they were a little left of center. I remember Rabbi Dr. Mendel Lewittis. You fellas don't recognize the name. I'm sure Rabbi Reuben recognizes the name. He was the rabbi in Montreal. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik.
He was a rabbi in the Bethel synagogue in Boston.
And he was in Boston first, correct? Then he came to Montreal. Then he came in Aliyah, and he published extensively. He was a Talmud Chacham. He told me the first thing the Sanhedrin has to do is abolish kidniyot on Pesach. How can there be an Isha? I remember his words, quote and quote. Now, if so many people wanted to abolish kidniyot, I need not tell you that right at the forefront was the Besom of Rosh. But the reason he gives, how it began, I have never seen this reason anywhere else. Umasha sha'altem, bidvah ha'kidniyot ha'orez ha'dochim b'Pesach, Shemiksat Rabbanei Ashkenaz Osrim. Notice he uses the word miksat, some. I've yet to find an Ashkenaz Rav who will eat beans on Pesach. And you know what's amazing? That when you buy cans, you'll see on beans and corn, kosher le Pesach, kosher le Pesach. I have to tell you, I was able to benefit from living in Israel. Because for whatever the reasons were, I think it was our new kitchen, we made Pesach about 2 weeks early. And my greatest joy was to have corn and string beans, and wow, I was able to have a good time before Pesach with all the kidneyot available here.
But did you have it on Pesach too?
No, on Pesach, before Pesach. Can't have it on Pesach. I'm an Ashkenaz. What can I do? I mean, but this is the question.
He's saying if he was the rush, so he's acting, he's saying at the time of the rush, maybe he's saying only a few Ashkenazim didn't allow it.
Could be. He's faking. He's making believe it's the rush. So he's talking about at that time a few Ashkenazim didn't allow it. But he says, look into this.
What's the number?
Shin Memchet. It's right beyond the other chair. He says, this is crazy, he says. How can people have a minute not to eat legumes if it goes against the Gemara? The Gemara permitted it. And we don't have any source for any labriot, any basin. We have no concept of a Beit Din that made a takana. And he says we have no right to justify this minhag. And the people who follow this minhag don't know what they're doing. And then he says, how did it begin? And he says, for Karov Hadavar, I have a theory. I would like to believe. When the Jews were driven out of a certain country and they were exiled and they came to this new community, and in this new community they found a little Karaite community, and the Karaites were so stupid that they took the Gemara literally, that chametz means fermentation. They took the concept literally, and they didn't understand there's a difference between cornbread to regular bread. And they said anything that can ferment and you can use for bread, you cannot eat on Pesach. And the Ashkenazim who came to this community followed this concept. They were misled. Avo and Avo Anu. Chalila lasad barim hamutarim. Chas v'chalila. We should prohibit that which is permissible. And then he says, and all the more the poor people. Ein lechem basa b'lechem lisboa kol yamei ha-moed. These poor people have no meat, don't have enough matzah. What are we doing to them? Don't we have to be concerned with these people? We have to give them something to eat. Something to sink their teeth into. They can't just eat fresh vegetables. Litra yerek besuda. That's not enough. It's not filling. And he says, we have to do everything possible. V'hamachmirin, those that are machmir, atidin v'tein et hadin. God will punish them. wow, this is a powerful tshuva. So he lines up in the name of the Rosh with all the other Ashkenazim, like the Chacham Tzvi, later Rabbi Yaakov Emden, and continues until today. There's a graduate of Lakewood, what's his name? Bar Shalom, am I giving the right name? Has a blog, and he wrote a tshuva here in Israel. He lives in Israel, being mater legumes for all Ashkenazim. What is his thinking based upon? The prohibition of legumes is limited to the locality in which you live. When you come to Eretz Yisrael, you're coming to the land where the Beis Yosef was the Mora Diatra, right? And if you come to Eretz Yisrael, then automatically you have to follow the Beis Yosef. And I believe it's, what's his name? I think it's Bar Shalom. Ben Chaim, could be Harab Ben Chaim. So Lakewood graduate, he has a whole website. He's a big Talmud Chacham, I'm told. And he was mat there, and last year there were letters to the editor, where did I see it, in Jerusalem Post. People praised him and thanked him. It's the first Pesach in Israel they ever enjoyed. They could eat all over. They didn't have to look at the labels and the cans. They could really partake of the Simchat HaYantar. Let me tell you, a problem it is. Can we be Matir? I can't be Matir. Legumes per se. We're Ashkenazim. Rabbi Vajer already answered that you Ashkenazim have to suffer. Even he didn't go as far as to say the Mura Diatra here is the Beis Yosef. But this Lakewood graduate, and Lakewood hasn't had too much mazel with its famous poskim who have come out of there. There's another great posek who, what was his method of writing the Torah? What's it called? I know, Rabbi, the silk screen method, right? I wanted to see the way he did it. My daughter knows his wife. He's in America. He went back to Lakewood now. He's in America. He was he's in Israel. Now he's in America. So my daughter spoke with his wife. She said, my husband doesn't want anyone to look. He's had enough aggravation. See, he thought I would come out with a nisa. Chas v'chalila. I just wanted to see what the procedure is, like it had some handle on what the shaila is. You understand? Evidently, from what I'm told, it's like writing a Sefer Torah with like a kid. Gets these, when I was a kid, they used to have... what do you call it?
Templates?
Stencils. No, it's a stencil. I used to get a stencil, and you could write with the stencil, and you could have good penmanship. Is that what they mean, that he has like a stencil, and he and how does he fill it in?
You put the ink on the top, and then you take a squeegee,
and you rub it over the stencil.
And then pull out the
stencil. Yeah, wow. You've seen it. Wow. But is that considered a ketav yad?
So that's the shaila. The Ma'ariv thinks it's not. It's based on
Chatzofos.
Right.
Very fascinating. And he claims that it lowers the cost of about 20% of what the...
It's about $1,000.
No, it's $10,000. A regular Sefer Torah is $30,000.
$30,000, and this lower would be...
Lower is
$20,000. Wow.
Yeah, $10,000.
Let me tell you, Lakewood has a real problem with the postgame, it turns out. And I read his defense. He mentions all the Lakewood Yeshivis. He says, they studied with me, they were my Talmidim, how can they differ with me, etc. But I'll tell you, there's a lot involved here that I'll talk about tomorrow, that you'll understand. It fits in to what I want to talk about tomorrow, so you'll understand what sucked. But anyway, halacha l'maisa, I don't want anyone to misunderstand me. Even though I understand the Besama Rosh perfectly, and I understand the Chacham Tzvi perfectly, we cannot yet be matia legumes for Ashkenazim. Could be Biyamot HaMashiach, one second, with the Sanhedrin here, then it's a different story, because we don't have a formal takana, so it may be it's a little bit easier lahatir, but we have to wait. Hold on one second, Adam, yeah.
Does anyone know if he was knowing like this? Like
Halacha
l'maisa? Yeah.
I don't know. I also thought the same thing. My educated guess is no. That he was fenced in, his father his cousin, the Noda Yehuda. He goes to England. He's living with his brother. He was fenced in. A lot of research has to be done. You have to check whether his gravesite is available. You have to check whether, how did he die? Is the rumor that there was suicide, is there any truth to it? Or did people just make it up because of his will, his savoir? I don't believe so, but that's only a guess, because we have no written record. But what a tshuva, wow, right on, and it shows you the world in which he's living already, and I have a feeling he's traveling, he's seeing, he's meeting, he's doing. Yes, Rabbi Rubin.
In issue of Minhag HaMaseinu the other day, yeah. Even though, you know, so we don't eat for 10 days, we'll say. The world is not going to come apart then. We don't eat the stuff.
Right.
The same way, for example, we don't drink Goyish wine. I cannot figure out in any way possible why that should not be allowed. And yet, I'm not going to put it on my table.
No, but one second. With legumes, you say, we're talking at a time when there was little other food available. When we grew up, what did we have for Pesach? Come on. Eggs, potatoes, meat, prunes perhaps, I don't remember. That was it. Oranges, apples, that was it.
I remember the vegetables. Man asked the Rav once on Motzei Shabbos, are you allowed to have tomatoes?
Right.
The Rav, instead of laughing or ridicule, he says, where did your family come from? It came from Ukraine. He says, was there snow on the ground on Pesach? Of course. That's why you didn't have tomatoes.
Very good. And you should know that there are Jews who don't eat garlic on Pesach.
Yeah.
And you know why? Because I asked, how can garlic be a legume? They told me, because it has cloves, you can't see what's underneath. The choshesh, a drop of chametz got in. It's a very... It's unbelievable.
And
and I can tell you, the Eidah Harei did would not give a heksha on potato chips on Pesach. They said, we never had it. And you know what happened? Their kids started buying the potato chips with the Rabbanut. The kid is a kid. Today, every potato chip made in Israel has the Eidah Harei did in it. So you see, it goes. This has to do with the shiur I'm going to give tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, also in London, like the United States, is founded by Spartans, so he's living among them. And I think there's even some talk today that they officially defer to the Spartan shul, even though they're a minority now.
But as far as kashrut goes in London, they're more machmir than we are in America.
But he was probably in an era where he could say, much like this guy is saying, that the more they are, like, so to speak, of London was...
I don't know. Could be at that time. But today in London, for instance, Chal of Yisrael, the official rabbinate viewpoint is to be machmir in Chal of Yisrael. You don't see that in America. They're more machmir. I saw that right down the line.
Well, Rabbi Sachs came out against the whole thing of brain stuff.
Well, all right, brain death and heart death, this is a tremendous machloket, but that's on a different level.
Is this such a concept? Then where does a person get a heter to be
machmir? Here you're dealing with sefek ritzicha. It's not so simple. It's a very... I was told in the name of the Rav that the Rav said to some of his followers in Boston that on the issue of brain death, even the Vilna Gaon couldn't answer the question. That's what the Rav said.
That's
so even the Vilna Gaon. So for the Rav to say in the Vilna Gaon, you know, he was saying this is a question of sefek ritzicha. It's a low question. Okay, yes, anyone else want to ask? I want to move further, just introduce. Okay, now, what did I say a minute ago? I said a minute ago that people started to travel more, and they met people. Okay, they saw different minhagim. This is fine, this is good. But then we come to a shaila that absolutely reflects modern times. A shaila that has come up time and again. And what's amazing is this is the second shiva of the Besamim Rosh that was not reprinted in 1981. The second shiva that was censored. And I'm going to show you, not today, but next week, that this very Shaila appears in a Sefer that just came out a few months ago. It's just, beyond.
What is the book?
We'll get there next week.
You can't just show it to them. I don't offer.
Shabbat the Right Way, Resolving Halachic Dilemmas by Rabbi J. Simcha Cohen. Published by Urim in Israel. Who is Rabbi J. Simcha Cohen? Rabbi J. Simcha Cohen, who we went to Ravna together. I know him since 1962, 63. His father was Rabbi Meir Cohen, the Menachel, the administrative director of the Agudat HaRabbanim. His uncle was Rabbi Aaron Cohen, the Levush Mordechai son-in-law, the Chevron of Rosh Yeshiva. He comes from, I think, 18 generations of Rabbanim. Dor Achador Achador. J. Simcha studied with Rav Chutney. He's a Chaim Berlin Musmach. He's a fine Talmud Chacham. He's had a very interesting rabbinic career, which took him to California. He was in Hancock Park. Later, he was in Melbourne, Australia. And today, he couldn't get the rabbinate out of his system. He could come in Aliyah. He could live anywhere. He couldn't get the rabbinate out of his system. I taught his daughter in Midrashit Moriah, and I was his guest in Melbourne. And he today is with in a senior citizen's residence, like an area in West Palm Beach, I think it's called, in Florida, where you have many retirees, and he's rabbi of the shul there. He still remains in the rabbinate. He's my age probably to the year. What he doesn't know is that I found out this past year that we are related. We both descend from the Kalvariski family in Kovna, which produced so many great rabbanim, including Rav Dov Revel, and including his uncle Rav Aaron Cohen, his father Rav Meir Cohen, and on the contemporary generation, J. Simcha Cohen, and your humble servant.
When they reissue the book on Dov Revel, add in.
Yeah, it could be. Could be. I'll put them to the introduction.
Who allowed us to choose from the second edition?
Who, the publisher?
Well, how come they didn't leave out the Tisha B'Av?
Interesting. Why he chose these two? Evidently because permitting suicide or encouraging suicide, people walked away feeling you can kill yourself. It's nishkefelik. It's not terrible. You follow? So there were Choshesh Dad, and here you have Mamish Kilul Shabbos. So when you're dealing
with...
The Kidney Shaila was republished. That's it's not even the Rabbanim, it's a Minna.
Oh, so what is the second one?
Ah, we're ready to begin. Okay, what's the question here? We'll just do the question and we'll deal with the answer next week. Gentlemen, you're traveling. How many of you travel on Friday? What happened with the guys going to Lakewood, the girls going to Lakewood a few years ago? The big snowstorm on Friday, stuck on the freeway, sunset is 4:30, and here it is, 3:00 in the afternoon, and the chances are you're not going to come into Lakewood until 7-8 o'clock at night. No, do you remember? You don't remember. How many of you travel on Friday? Aaron Rakefet, I try my best not to do anything more than local traveling on Friday. The Gemara in Pesachim, Minhag HaMakom, Makom Shenagu, there's a whole parak that deals with Makom Shenagu, different minhagim, and whether you can travel, what was it, Tetsua, Tetsidon, how far you're allowed to go Friday. Gentlemen, Bnei Akiva, there was a family in the Bronx, the Abramson family. The father was a sheikhid, as I recall. Raised four daughters, if I'm correct, all four remained from. To raise four daughters and all four remain from in the Bronx of the 1940s, 1950s is an unbelievable achievement. One of the girls was going up to the mountains, what, a bungalow, wherever, on a Friday, traffic, rain, accidents. There was no way she could get there before Shabbat. She jumped out of the cab, whatever she was taking, the vehicle, left her luggage. Oh, she jumped out with her luggage off the bus, went into a garage, explained her problem, left the luggage in the garage, said she would come back Saturday night, went into the community, looked for a Jew, a shul, a place to stay over Shabbat.
It's not a
bus. It was, excuse me?
A bus is not.
See, right away, he's matir. It was a great Kiddush Hashem. Lakewood, that's, I don't remember all the details. Don't quote me exactly, because it's not that I knew the details. I only knew it from afar, because there was a tremendous discussion here. There were two buses going. One, I think, was Beis Yaakov girls, and one with boys to Lakewood, or Beis Yaakov girls, and a different group. The people going to Lakewood called a Rosh Yeshiva until today. We don't know the name. He remains nameless. He never stepped forward. And they told him they're stuck on the bus at Sakonet Nefashet. They have no place to go. They're on the highway. And the Rosh Yeshiva paskin like Nachum Lam. Continue. And they came into Lakewood 3 hours after Shabbat began. The other bus, I think it had Beis Yaakov girls from Staten Island, stopped the bus, nearest Jewish community. They had a Chabad shul, a Chabad rabbi. All the girls were put up for Shabbos by the families around the Chabad shul. No? Who was right? Who was wrong? The Abramson girl, I remember after Shabbat she came back to the garage. These were goyim. They guarded her suitcases with such respect. Like that guy sitting next to that non-Jew, let me not use the word guy because it has a pejorative overtone. That non-Jew sitting next to Rabbi Riskin with the greatest of respect. This was exactly the question that the Vesamim Rosh gets. You're on a buggy. You're traveling. You get stuck. Something went wrong. The carriage broke down. The wheel has to be fixed. Shabbos is coming. If you get off, you're finished. You don't know where you are. What will you eat? Where will you sleep? You're in danger. Oh no. Shabbat is Shabbat. This was the question. And if he paskins like Nachum Lam, which he does, you can understand the flying why they left it out. Mamish, Mater, Chilul, Shabbos.
It's a horse.
A horse and buggy at that time.
It's a
horse-drawn carriage. And a car is better than a horse?
A car is the arrest.
A car is what?
Horse is
So you mean today it's worse?
Yeah, yeah.
And today it may be. Maybe today it's worse. Well, we'll see. We'll see. You can make... It's an unbelievable question.
But is there an issue of membership in the middle of the course?
We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. Because that's exactly what these people told the anonymous Rosh Yeshiva when they called them from the bus on the turnpike. That if they get off the bus, it's pikuach nefesh, they have nowhere to go, the snow is coming down, etc. So let me reiterate. Shin, no. What number tshuva is this? Shin ayin hey. 375. Left out in the 1881 edition. Republished in 1983, because by now, this question has been asked in 100 different variations. But you got to remember, by 1881, you had the first breakthrough of Chilul Shabbos in Eastern Europe. It wasn't widespread, but it was there. To be Mata Chilul Shabbos could open up a Pandora's box. So to reiterate, what did we do today? We did the suicide question. Fascinating question. And left out, and yet today, everyone paskins in accordance with the thinking of the B'Sam and Rosh. They don't have to quote him. There are many other sources to indicate he's right.
In the Maisha, when you first started in October,
yeah,
you went into detail that Yabia Omer,
right,
he quotes Rosh.
Right, right.
And he says,
Lo lap nisha amah elamasha ne'emah. We'll come back to that at the end. And Kitniyot on Pesach, fascinating tshuva, and it shows you what bothered them. And this is a topic that doesn't leave us until today. Yes, I have, 1 second, a freebie.
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow, it won't, pass this back to me.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
And I'm giving out videos if anyone's interested, all on you. And we introduced the next shiva that was left out, riding on Shabbos when the carriage breaks down and you're stuck in the middle of nowhere. Gentlemen, tomorrow is a very important shiur. Halacha l'maisa. The Rebbe dealing with the left-wing world, and even though I have more complaints about the Haredim than anyone I know, I'm not willing to change Torah Hashem. Why? What determines? What is the main factor? And I'm coming back to where I began. I'm ending off with Solomon Schechter, and I'm taking his philosophy and showing you he was 100% correct with one slight mistake. And when I follow his thinking, I have solved all problems. And I end off with Jewish Action, the latest issue, adding to Rav Schechter's article and illuminating Rabbi Manny Feldman's article. Now, a few interesting freebies. First of all, there are videos here. Whoever wants, you're welcome to it. They're all OG videos. These are the latest coins. If anyone needs a gift, it's the only gift you can buy that basically they can't